The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Border crossing at Rafah is set to reopen since its closure back in May of 2024. It'll be the first time people will be allowed to move between Gaza and Egypt in nearly 2 years. Egyptian authorities are said to be preparing to provide aid to anyone wounded or injured who comes across the border. Now, the decision comes as the remains of the final deceased hostage in Gaza, Ran Gvili, have been recovered. I'm joined on the line by UNICEF spokesperson James Elder. James, good morning.
Pat, good morning to you.
Now, the reopening of the Rafah crossing has got to be good news. But tell me what things are like on the ground at the moment in Gaza. I mean, are you able to do your work?
Yeah, wildly good news, Pat, if it happens and meant to happen on Sunday, as you said there. I mean, it's the door, it's the gateway for families, for trade, for aid, for medical care. So, yeah, that's huge if it happens and happens at scale. Look, things have improved hugely in terms of us being able to do our work. There's no doubt about that, Pat. I mean, we've opened scores of nutrition centres. We've got in, I don't know, 1 million thermal blankets, hundreds of thousands of winterisation kits. The rebuilding, I see, of water systems and plants based on ingenuity, not based on being allowed spare parts in, based on Palestinians, is extraordinary. So there's a lot to look to. And there's hundreds of thousands of kids we've got going back to school, Pat. But the reality remains that, you know, you've got people in these windswept tents going sideways. I walked through the rain of that literally just to feel it, knowing that people have been dealt with it for 2 years. How does a kid get warm again? I don't quite understand that. And of course, if you're a young child, you had your immune system shattered for 2 years. That's why we've seen 10 children die of hypothermia. So it remains miserable, I have to say. And I think, Pat, that just speaks to that life is so grim, so perilous, that despite all those things I can rattle off that UNICEF's doing, it just speaks to how vast the destruction was and how unprecedentedly brutal this war's been.
Now, when we try to think of the size of Gaza, we often compare it to County Meath in Ireland, about that size, which is only a fraction of the landmass of Ireland. So it is a very concentrated place, is Gaza. Is there any element of it that is relatively untouched? I mean, are there villages, are there towns where most of the buildings are still standing?
No, Pat, there's not. And every time I go back, and I've been seven times now since the atrocities of the 7th of October, but it doesn't matter how many times I climb up rubble and try and get a bird's eye view and I look to 360 degrees of devastation, my jaw drops every single time. I take photos of things I've seen 20 times before. So there's not, and there's not anywhere on the Gaza Strip. And of course, now Israel occupies more than half of it. So Palestinians, that, you know, population of just over 2 million, a million girls and boys, are crammed into an even smaller area. They go home when they can. That's why when I talk of, you know, UNICEF building temporary learning spaces or a primary healthcare clinic in the north, that's massive. That says to people, we can go back. But they go back, Pat, and they put tents on top of rubble or side by side rubble. Then they start to try to build vegetable gardens. But still, they're under threat if they're really far to the north and near that yellow line. They're still a threat of sniper fire and so on. That's a reality. You know, 100 girls and boys have been killed during the ceasefire. I mean, that's just, you know, that's staggering. Whilst, you know, so when, I mean, clearly a ceasefire that slows bombs is good, but one that still buries children is not enough. But no, to answer your question, there's not a single point of the Gaza Strip where you cannot see that devastation and where families aren't trying to live within it.
Now, the rain, the cold, the rubble, the devastation. On top of that, there would be the worry, I'm not sure if it's at the forefront of people's minds, the worry of unexploded ordnance buried in the rubble.
Oh, 100%, 100%. And it's, you know, families are going back to try and shift rubble. We've had injuries through that. That when I talk of 100 children being killed, that is through strikes or drones. That's not through things like UXOs, but absolutely. And it's all the more reason, if you go back to that first point about Rafah, you know, that it is a lifeline as well for medical evacuations. That medical evacuations, whether it's through UXOs or those children who've got cancer or leukemia or mums with, you know, with breast cancer, things that are eminently treatable. There's a couple of things. Rafah needs to open. European countries, Ireland's been good. Italy's been very good. Many others have been very, very poor. Egypt's taken 6,000 people. The European Union's taken less than 10% of that across all its countries. And if that doesn't happen, you know, there's a little boy I met, okay, he's got a name, but he's 9. He's all his family, his aunts and uncles, Pat, they call him the cheeky one because he got a real spark. And I met him in June, but he's lost many of his siblings. He was hiding between his mum and his dad when they were sleeping when another airstrike, the second one, hit. It killed his mum and his dad. This little boy, when I saw him most recently for the third time a couple of weeks ago, he barely speaks now. The only time his uncle says he really talks is in the middle of the night when he has these night terrors. Now, he's going to lose a leg if he doesn't get a medical evacuation. There's just no reason apart from, well, European countries not opening their doors or I'd say their hearts to kids like that.
Now, in terms of getting out through the Rafah crossing, what are the Israelis doing on the Gaza side of the border in terms of triaging people who might qualify to get out?
Yeah, I don't have the intricacies and we'll have to see on Sunday. And obviously it'll be heavy, heavy security, of course. But the mechanism, these deals around the ceasefire, phase two, if you will, is very clear, you know, that aid has to proceed, quote unquote, without interference, and that Rafah opens, quote unquote, in both directions. So how that looks, I don't know. Obviously, there's an immense security apparatus there. Let's hope it's done with dignity as well. We don't see that in the West Bank, people living under occupation, you know, where the abnormal is just pushed upon people as being normal. So let's hope it's done with proper numbers. We're hearing like 50 to 100 a day. Obviously, that would not, you know, is not sufficient. It's not just the wounded. You know, so frequently, Pat, I'd see these men and grandfathers, charging their phones in some place, trying to get some connectivity, trying to get some juice in their phones so that they could call grandchildren, spouses, partners who they haven't seen for 2 years. I don't think anyone's really spoken so much about that for a, you know, dad who stayed behind if his kids and wife got out, or a grandfather who entire all his grandchildren and children got out. They haven't seen these people for 2 years. So the idea of that reconnection is something that is weighing very, very heavily on families.
Has the risk of famine been eliminated now? I mean, is there enough food getting in to feed the population?
Yeah, it's a great question, Pat. Yes, for now. Famine's on retreat. There is no famine there now. As I say, UNICEF set up 70 nutrition centres. There is much more food in terms of nutritious food as well in the markets. Now, remembering if a kilogram of tomatoes no longer costs $30, only costs $5, but you haven't had an income for a year, you don't have $5, it's still not relevant. But yes, it has. But I think what this shows as well, and what we tried to say time and again, is this was man-made. This was man-made scarcity. This was engineered. And in the same way, suddenly you open the doors and you allow commercial goods or an agency like UNICEF to set up 70 nutrition centres, and we reverse famine in a millisecond. That's because it was man-made. That also means that men can restart these nutritional disasters. And of course, if you're a little child and you've dealt with 2 years of nutritional deprivations, the damage has been done.
Now, the question of the markets, you know, I'm intrigued that in the middle of all of this destruction that you kind of the merchants are out there, you know, buying stuff. Where they buy it, I don't know, at a wholesale rate and then passing it on at a retail rate to some of the people. How does that market system work? Where is the food coming from?
So the food comes, the commercial good, everything comes through Israel until Rafah opens. Everything will still come through Israel. That's humanitarian aid. So, you know, the UNICEF and WFP have been about 80% of humanitarian aid. And then there's commercial trucks that pay to bring in whether it's, honestly, they can bring in chocolate, they can bring in vegetables, they can bring in coffee, all those things. But again, it's just only a certain portion of people that have funds, particularly for, you know, things like chocolate or coffee. Now, for things like fruit and vegetable, that's one of the reasons UNICEF reaches hundreds of thousands of families with cash assistance so that they can go and make those decisions of what they can afford. That's critical, but we need much more of that. We need to not do cash assistance three times to vulnerable people. We need to do it on a monthly basis. So the market reappears, and that's education. You know, you and I have spoken a lot about that, Pat. It's the future for Palestinians. I saw these graduates at Shifa Hospital, 150 students graduating to be doctors amid the rubble. It's extraordinary. So, you know, in the aftermath of war, restoring education is about restoring possibility, and it's how markets come back. It's why these engineers are rebuilding with tape and ingenuity, not spare parts. Education, education.
Now, the question of power, electricity generation, is that also coming from Israel, and how reliable is it? Water, you know, desalination plants bombed, how secure is the water supply? How clean, how reliable?
Yeah, great question. So unfortunately, yes, electricity is controlled by Israel when they turn it on and off, particularly to big power plants. So we've still had problems with fuel. We shouldn't be using fuel. We should be using power. That's up to those authorities. Incredible work I've seen. I mean, there was a massive water plant in the north, but it was bombed. it was bombed as forces were leaving. And so immense damage. And what they managed to do there was, because the sewage had got so bad, they reverse engineered it. So instead of pumping water out, it pumped sewage in for the last 6 months. Now they're trying to reverse engineer that again. Again, this is why that education is so critical there and why the literacy rates are so high. But no, it's not a guarantee day by day to have the electricity that Palestinians need, nor to have the electricity that those desalination plants need, that too often can be turned on and off.
Do Palestinians feel a bit neglected now? I mean, they've had their announcement of the Board of Peace and all those international politicians and Tony Blair among them going to be looking after them going forward. But do they feel a bit neglected given, you know, the focus on Greenland, on Venezuela, and now on Iran?
I think that they've always been very, very astute in terms of geopolitics. And so they're well aware, as you say, of those things. And yes, and I think that they will feel the ceasefire had an unintended effect, and that is that they, Palestinian children in particular, have disappeared from view. Many of them don't feel things are completely over because, well, 100 children have been killed since a ceasefire. They don't have full access. They are still trapped. There are many reasons. So, yes, of course, that things have improved. But what the world calls calm would still be considered a crisis anywhere else. It was a teacher I spoke to, Pat, who said, doesn't feel like a war. It feels like wars. It's a war on winter. It's a war on prices. So, yes, they, you know, again, the enormity of the devastation that they have endured means that this doesn't get solved in 3 months, particularly 3 months as it's been, without unfettered humanitarian access, without unfettered movement, and without a full end to any type of conflict.
Now, you mentioned that they're in touch with what's going on in the greater world, and they have shown their own resilience in terms of rebuilding, as you say, with, elastic bands and gaffer tape, because in the absence of spare parts and so on. But is there any confidence that, you know, the reconstruction will actually be meaningful for them and bring some sort of prosperity, even in the long term, never mind the medium term, to Gaza?
So many Palestinians I've spoken to, and I've asked of that, like, what's their decision making when it comes to, do they stay, do they go? The vast majority do point to education, and there is a reason why that literacy rate has been maintained over years and decades of attacks and difficulties, and it's been education. So I think that obviously they want to go home. Obviously they want the full Gaza Strip. If your home's on the other side of that yellow line, you can't even access the rubble. So when they talk of priorities, they talk of housing, but in the short term, they talk of education. They talk of if we can ensure that our children are going to school. Because for them, it's not just been about the physical destruction. They feel it's been an assault on their future. They feel that every child denied learning is that future engineer or doctor or just thinker. So I think for Palestinians, the physical reconstruction is critical. They don't see it in the short term. They see themselves doing everything like that in the short term. They see getting their children into classrooms of any sort as a real priority for feeling like something is normal and something is eyeing a future beyond just survival.
Now, we've talked on this program before about mental health in children who've witnessed some terrible things. And going forward, that must be a concern that, as you mentioned, that young boy earlier on, the light has gone out of his eyes, you know, the spark has gone. And that'll be true for so many people right across the strip.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is a myth. And again, I'm sorry to get bash on education, but I was in a school where, you know, there were, I don't know, 100 14-year-old girls. And then there was an end of session and in came 100 7-year-olds and they sprinted. It was just this rainbow of color coming through and you could see, okay, this is how you change things. You get them some normality. You get them around friends. You get them in a classroom slowly, slowly. But for every one of those children I saw, there were five outside who are not getting education yet. It's why UNICEF is pushing that. So that's part of it. But the other part is that they actually do get to go home, that they don't hear drones anymore. There is a level of scarring and of trauma that is going to take such a long time to combat. And we're not at that point yet. And it requires a rounded effort. It requires a rebuilding of an economy. It requires the agriculture to be rebuilt so that their parents, so that children feel that their parents have that sense of normality as well. So it's a huge amount. I do think there is a resilience. It sounds like a cliche, Pat, but you see kids play, you see them respond. So I think for the majority of them, if there is a genuine peace and the world doesn't turn away, and by that I mean education and homes and economies for mum and dads, then most will start to recover. But yes, we still remain in uncharted territory because children still hear drones and children still once a week hear the sounds of a missile.
James Elder of UNICEF. James, thank you very much for joining us on the programme today.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.